This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And here today, tonight, depending on upon which coast you're on, I have my guy, Brian Brewer, co-hosting with me. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Diana.
And we're going to have, I think, quite a provocative interview with Nina Hartley. Hello, Nina, and welcome.
Hello, hello.
It is wonderful to have you here. You know, I suggested in the promo for this program that I recorded last week that you are a registered nurse, and I know you graduated summa cum laude.
Magna cum laude, not summa, magna. The one down from the top.
Oh, well, anyway, that's still pretty good.
Is that magna cum laude? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, but boom, boom, yeah. I've never heard that joke before.
Anyway, but of course, the listening audience may be more interested in your adult industry career, and it's still going strong after, what, some 28 years in the business?
Well, in March will be 29 years, but 30 years since I started dancing to get myself through school.
Yes, and you stripped at the Mitchell Brothers Theater, yeah?
I did. That was a lot of fun, I will tell you that.
What's your favorite memory from that?
Being able to do live hardcore sex with women on stage,
and
wow, yeah, which is, you know, sex with women was one of the primary reasons, one of the two main reasons I got into adult entertainment. The other was, of course, to spread my message about sex, but definitely get my hands on the ladies, because back in the 80s, it was very difficult to do that.
And you've been a lifelong bisexual, I guess.
I am. I first thought I might be back in late middle school, and then by the time I was 14, I realized it wasn't a phase, and I was definitely a bisexual person. Although I didn't do anything about it till I was 18. I mean, 18, mm-hmm. I didn't have sex with anybody until I was 18, unless you count, you know, whatever little kids do together when they play doctor. So I waited a goodly time, even when friends of mine all over the place were all having sex while still in high school. I refrained.
You have so much enthusiasm, and I suspect that's one thing that's kept you in the business this long. Brian and I both heard you speak at the Quad S meeting last April in Los Angeles, and I'm quoting you, "I want for people to have more pleasure, and you want for people to be more competent and confident."
Yes, those are all things. More pleasure, because pleasure is our birthright as humans. Human animals are very unique among the mammalian world in that we enjoy sex year-round. We have no season. We have no breeding season or mating season. And the sexual response cycle is very, very finely tuned and highly evolved. And so if pleasure was not an important aspect of human bonding, we would not have selected for these systems in our bodies. Women would not have clitorises. We wouldn't care about sex pleasure. We would just be literally the incubator for the baby. But it is not so. And cultures all over the world constrain how people can express pleasure, experience pleasure, with whom, under what circumstances, for what reasons. And in the modern West, we have a lot of freedom, and we're still constrained by our upbringing. So my hope is to help people find their way through the thicket of their conditioning into the truth of what it is they really want.
It's so important. If so many people could just, if many people could just say what they want, and there's a four-letter word that ends in K, but it isn't what you think, and so many people would be so much happier if they did more of it, and that's talk.
Yeah, go boom, boom. Excellent. Yeah. It is a four. But also talk with themselves. I mean, many people
talk to themselves.
You know,
yeah.
one of the things that I recommend always for people who are still struggling with this is we have to decide as adults, you know, what of my upbringing and my value system do I want to keep, and what do I need to set down because it does not work in my life? And that is very scary for most people because it might mean rejecting your family of origin. It might mean breaking from your family's religious practice. It might mean subjecting yourself to rejection by them or worse. And so, but learning how to figure out what, who and what am I alone in a room with the doors locked and the windows shut helps us then figure out, okay, now that I know and I accept, what do I do? And I think people fear that if I accept it for myself, I'm going to have to go and do it. It's like, no, you just have to accept it in yourself so it no longer drives your behavior, which may be harmful to yourself. Until we accept ourselves fully as sexual beings and what that sexuality is, we stuff it, we squish it, we hide it, we drug it, we try to kill it, and it still motivates our behavior, may make us take bad relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So self-awareness, we've got to start there. And self-awareness comes from sitting with yourself in a room with your hand extended to where it most naturally rests and paying attention.
Well, Nina, that's great, and I love the way that you're out there providing lots of education and entertainment for people who have figured out, you know, what their sexual identity is and what their sexual path might be. But do you have any, you know, do you have any suggestions or for resources for someone who's earlier in the stage and is really trying to figure things out?
Well, there's wonderful books. Patrick Califia is a wonderful writer, Carol Queen, of course, Betty Dodson and her book, Sex for One, Orgasms for Two, are fundamental reading. Jamie Waxman has a lovely book on female masturbation, a wonderful book called Sex is Fun, is out there. The Guide to Getting It On is a very good book. My book, Nina Hartley's Guide to Total Sex,
we should emphasize that. People can read about that on your website.
But how people, the resources are privacy and time and the willingness to let your hand go to where it most naturally rests and then recalibrating one's relationship to physical pleasure. Because there's what the body likes in terms of stimulation, hard, soft, fast, slow, rough, gentle, circles, not circles, you know, whatever. There's the sensations that our bodies really like to experience. And then there's how we have been taught through culture and training to think about those likes and dislikes. And that is where the stress comes in. That's where the difficulty comes in. Because your body likes what it likes because it likes what it likes. Why do I like the color green? Why do I like licorice? I don't know. I just do. Why do I like being touched in this way? I don't know. I just do. But how I'm taught to think about what I like causes, how a person is taught to think about that causes most of the trouble, which drives them to therapy or drinks or drugs or whatever it is they use to distract themselves from accepting what it is they really want. Just because you accept what it is you really want does not mean you're going to go off and become a immoral, amoralistic, you know, rampaging sex machine. It doesn't mean that at all. But it does mean you feel a whole lot calmer and you realize, wow, I've expended so much emotional energy hating on myself and judging myself when I didn't have to do that. Wow, I feel so much better. And no behavior has to change. Most of this work is internal.
And sometimes people do need, here I'm putting in a plug for therapists like myself, because sometimes
I'm a big believer in therapy. If you need, no, get help, but see, you're a sex positive sex therapist, American family counselor, and people are often told, oh, talk to a therapist, but therapists are human and they can be just as messed up around sex and sexuality.
Many of them are.
As the next person, especially if you are going to one that has a religious basis for their philosophy, you're going to get someone who might try to keep you in that box or continue to shame you or try to train you away from your natural desires towards something that's more acceptable. So be very careful if you feel any judgment on the part of the therapist. You should thank them very much and find another therapist, because we're just talking about desires here. No wrong desires, only wrong action. So getting comfortable with who and what you want goes a long way to being able to decide, is any of that practical in real life?
Yes, non-judgmental therapists, sex-positive therapists are very important, and you probably know of Dan Savage?
Yes, I have a lot of admiration for him.
Yes, we all do, or not all of us.
Right, no, but, not all of us, no, for sure.
But many do. And he quoted Marty Klein in a recent column and how Marty suggested that you actually interview your therapist on the phone and find out about their attitudes.
What a great idea.
That's a great idea. It is. And Brian, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think it's, you know, there are a lot of therapists and other people in the helping professions that do have less than positive attitudes about sexuality. And I think it's important for anyone who's exploring that to really check them out first and find out.
Yeah, and get, of course, a lot of people talk about the fact that they're in therapy, but if you can get references, and don't underestimate the fact that even a generally sex-positive therapist can be triggered by something you do or say.
Right.
And all of a sudden, again, prove themselves to be all too human, which can be disconcerting because we do put therapists on a pedestal, but yet they're human, and they do, and you can't be a good therapist without having your humanity on full display, not just your empathy, but also your reactions to people. But I'm a great believer in therapy. There are a lot of wonderful books out there that help a person along who doesn't want to talk to other people try to figure out what's going on. But and also, really, for me, back in the 70s, the first thing I did before I learned how to masturbate was I learned how to receive non-sexual therapeutic massage while learning how to breathe past my second rib.
Oh, good for you. You were ahead of your time for being so young to know to do that.
Well, luckily for me, I had parents who, I grew up in Berkeley, California in the 60s and 70s. I was born in 59. So my parents were seekers. They're already trying to figure out what was going on in their lives, and so they picked up all kinds of therapy, and I watched them do it: Primal Scream, Reikian, bioenergetics, biofeedback, guided mescaline, group therapy, you name it, marriage counseling. They did it all in trying to figure out what was going to work for them. In the end, Zen Buddhism worked for them. But for a while, specifically sexual body-based therapy was what they were after. And so that's when I learned about the Reichian theory of body armor, and I recognized that I had all the symptoms of being repressed. I had a tight jaw. I couldn't breathe very deeply because the reasons you learn not to breathe too deeply because, oh, feelings are there. Oh, yeah, right, feelings. Ah! And then massage as a non-sexual thing, as, you know, a body-based therapeutic modality was being promoted in the Bay Area at that time, with a non-creepy, non-icky, non-sleazy way to become healthier. And so I was able to take advantage of that. If I'd been raised in any other place at the same time, I would have been much older before I was exposed to these ideas. So I'm very grateful that I grew up when and where I did, and with parents who already were off the grid.
Yes, that's very unusual. You were fortunate.
Yes. Very fortunate. I got a head start. Very, very fortunate indeed.
And so were they always pretty much accepting of your career choices?
Oh, gosh, no. No, no, no.
No?
Oh, no, no, no. Don't forget, my father's born in 1915. My mother born in 1926. Mm-hmm. And she is a little more of the old school feminist, you know, in that women, as even though she wanted to like sex more, and she did make some progress on that, the idea of a daughter being a sex worker was just beyond her comprehension. It's been 30 years. She's better at it, accepting it, but she still thinks maybe it's a phase. I think she would like to be able to say what her daughter does and not have to gulp before she says it. So, you know, she's of a generation that appearances matter, and what other people think is appropriate still matters to her. But she doesn't give me any grief over it. She doesn't, you know, I'm the youngest of four. She's learned how to keep her mouth shut over a lot of her children's choices. She would prefer I do something else, but she understands I'm not hurting myself, I'm not hurting anybody else, and that's as good as it's going to get. I'm totally okay with it.
she sounds.
Well, that's a lot better than some folks in your profession experience.
Thank you. Exactly. I mean, some parents in this business are fully supportive of their kids. I mean, I remember several women over the years have brought their parents to the award ceremony. It's like, that's okay.
You're talking about your award, the AVN.
Yes, exactly. My parents don't need to do that. But, you know, I'm the only differently sexed one of the four kids. Everyone else is monogamous and heterosexual, so I'm the only one that's outside of the box in terms of my sexual expression. And it just was disconcerting to them because they didn't quite get it. My dad once asked me, why sex? Why not the violin?
Why didn't you stay in nursing?
because in our culture, sexuality is sick, and sick people need a nurse's care. So to be a good therapist, and you know this, to be a good therapist, you have to have a low center of gravity. And in whatever area that you are doing your therapy in, you have to have a great deal of personal growth yourself so that you can be helpful to others. I would be a lousy drug counselor. I don't have patience for it. I don't have an understanding of it. I've never struggled with addiction. I'm not compassionate over people's struggles with drugs and alcohol. And I would be lousy at it. I've done my struggles with body acceptance and sexual acceptance and self-worth. People who really want to make friends with their body, I can help because I have a lot of patience for that. And so sex is my thing the way that, you know, pandas are somebody else's things, or Japanese pottery glazes are somebody else's things, or studying the, you know, mitochondrial DNA, RNA of Neanderthals is somebody else's thing. So sex is my thing because I'm bisexual, exhibitionistic, non-monogamous, blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's just, sex is my thing. I don't know how to say it any differently. And my parents are finally understanding, oh, sex is her thing.
Well, it comes across in your films. You're enthusiastic, and a study was done that showed that what men wanted most in a woman was enthusiasm and so, wanting her to initiate more, to be really present.
That's so interesting that you say that, because when I hear when women complain, oh, he wants me to be like, you know, a girl in the movie, and I try to tell them, once you get past the grooming differences, she has professional makeup, she gets her nails done, she shaves within an inch of her life, the pornographic fantasy, air quotes around that, in pornography is of a woman who is horny, enthusiastic, and not afraid to say it. That's what, so it goes, that dovetails completely with that. So think about so-called women's pornography, which is a romance novel. So the innocent, beautiful young girl somehow finds a rich, experienced, sophisticated, sexually mature man who in the end will give it up and be monogamous with her and is wealthy. So that is so-called female woman's pornography. Very, very unrealistic that you are going to, that someone with so little experience is going to dazzle a man of greater wealth and experience into being monogamous with her. Well, in male pornography, the fantasy in our culture, sex is hard to get for men. You have to pay for it, you know, subtly or outright. There's a lot of courtship. You know, she can still say no. It's complicated. So in porn, of course, the fantasy is your shirt is blue. I must have you. Of course, the fantasy is going to be, it's going to be easy sex with women who are in the mood, because in real life, women are not allowed to be in the mood because that makes them sluts. And so he has to do all the courting, and then she has to pretend that he loves her, that she loves him, and then it's okay. And then if it comes out that he doesn't love her, then she gets mad that you lied to me, but if I told you the truth, you'd get mad at me, et cetera, et cetera. So women's sexual virtue is man's greatest invention, and it's hamstrung everybody.
And it's a lot of drama. And Brian, I know you have a comment here.
Well, I coined a new term the other day when I was listening to a friend. The term was dramaphilia.
Dramaphilia, I love it. Oh my God! Can I quote you on that?
Yes,
can I quote
of course.
You on that? Dramaphilia. I call them just, you know, crazy bitches, but okay.
Dramaphilia.
or addicted to crazy. My ex was addicted to misery. Some people addicted to crazy. But dramaphilia, thank you very much. I will absolutely start using that term.
We use it, yes.
Because it's true. Only because our culture is so messed up about sex. Again, we can't, a young woman cannot have normal interest, curiosity, and horniness because, oh my gosh, that makes her some kind of slut or a whore or whatever negative word that we use to scare women into not exploring themselves, and then men have to somehow overcome that by sweet and dulcet words when he may not love her. He just may be interested in her sexually. She may not love him, and she may be interested in him sexually, but they both have to agree to have this dance so that he can respect her in the morning, air quotes, and she does not have the dreaded, you know, term slut applied to her. But all slut means that someone is having sex of a type of which you disapprove. It has no actual meaning.
I've heard you say, Nina, that you'd rather be called a slut than a victim.
Oh, I haven't said that. I don't remember saying that, but I will quote myself on that one, too. Exactly.
I thought you said that in Los Angeles last night.
I could have. I don't remember all my pithy quotes. Thanks for taking notes. But it's hard. You know, as someone who's so outside of the box as to become a publicly sexual person, I am less harmed by people's ideas about me because I understand that we project onto an image our own stuff about it. And so people look at me and they either see the biggest slut or whore or danger to women in the world. They see the most beautiful woman in the world. They see what it is they need me to be.
And they project onto you.
They project, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm a public media person, and we project onto media all the time. That's what people do. We project.
Right.
And so when women say, you know, when a woman looks at a movie and says, oh, my gosh, they're being so degraded, that is her sharing with us what she would feel if she was in the same situation, because degradation is a subjective feeling. I cannot look at an image and say that person is degraded. People forget that because it's real body parts, it's actual vulvas and penises. People forget that pornography, above all else, is a paid professional performance. It is a cartoon. It is a burlesquing of cultural norms. It's a movie. And even though it isn't like a spy movie where you can erase the wires that hold the actor up above something and he looks to be flying or whatever it is, in pornography or explicit media, people get that mixed up because the genitals may be real, but everything else around the movie creation is completely artificial. The who, the what, the when, the why, the where, all that's decided by somebody else. So I may get to the set and I'm going to work with this person, and that part is quote unquote real, meaning it is my real vulva and their real genitals as well. We're touching each other that way, but everything else about it is artificial. And people forget that, because the shocking images of genitalia in action just seem to overwhelm people's minds.
And I think we have to remember that it is not sex ed.
No! I think like 0.01% of all the pornography, or 0.001 or 0.0001% of all the explicit material produced is designed to be educational, as in, try this at home, folks, you might have a better idea. The rest of it is pure entertainment. Stupid, silly, vulgar, shallow, dumb, juvenile, puerile, just, you know, offensive to the person viewing it, ugly, hostile, not pretty, beautiful, soft, boring, but it is just media designed to be consumed and thrown away. And people say but that's not what sex is about. Well, then those people don't need to consume adult material. You know, it's fine. It's out there. It's like a river. You can swim in the river or not. And if, you know, doing pornography of sex, then you should not view it. It's simple as that.
I have couples in my practice where a lot of them are couples in their 50s, and the woman's sex drive is down. She's perimenopausal or postmenopausal. He's consuming a lot of porn. And she's feeling left out, and I think one of the questions that is good for them to consider is, why is this so upsetting for me?
Right.
And to really look at it. Most men do not want to have the woman in the porn movie.
No, my God, she's high maintenance. She's too young. And you know, they don't.
High maintenance.
Yeah, you know, nails, hair, tanning, gym.
Yeah.
You know, it's
Nina, I would love to have Brian's male point of view about porn and just viewing it and sort of an overview or personal view or whatever you want to give.
That's a big question.
I know.
You know, pornography has been around for millennia, and it's not going to go away.
Nope.
And, you know, I mean, we could speculate on why men are much more attracted to it than women, and a lot of theories are that men are much more visually oriented in terms of turn-ons. But, but you know, I like what, you know, Diana, you mentioned Marty Klein earlier. This,
right.
You know, your colleague, he's in the Bay Area, I think, right?
He's in Palo Alto.
Yeah, and I mean, I've heard him speak several times, and he's got a pretty enlightened attitude about it, that porn is not really the problem. It's, you know, it's the something in the relationships.
Of course. It's never about the object, always about the subject. So replace porn with gambling, working, shopping,
anything,
hiding out in your garage, polishing your car, anything. So anything that takes me away from the relationship, it's not the thing itself that's the problem. It's the fact that I feel I need to remove myself from the relationship emotionally, and this is causing problems. Now, within couples who monogamy is important, and I know several women now whose sex drive dropped off a cliff at menopause. They went from being natively horny women who could totally like get in the mood to not giving a flying donut about it anymore, and some of them are happy to give it up. Some of them are very distressed over the change. I used to like it so much. I used to have such an easy time having orgasms, and now I don't. What do I do? And speaking as someone who has never been a horny person, I have never been, God, in 30-plus years of having sex, I can count on two hands the number of times where my vulva has urge me forward. So for me, sex has always been mental first, physical later. And so for me, as I'm approaching menopause, I'm not getting a change in my sex drive. It's always been head down, not crotch up for me. So, but what I've learned is I may not start off quote unquote in the mood, but I'm always willing to be gotten in the mood. I'm always willing to get in the mood.
Well, that willingness that counts.
There you go. There's that word, willingness. And so. So after you mourn the loss of your sexuality as it once was, because you're no longer 35, and a woman has gone from being a high sex drive person to stop. There's a mourning period. You and your partner have to mourn over the loss of what it used to be, and decide as a couple how are we going to address this now? How will we do this? So maybe we'll have sex once a week, and I will help you masturbate once a week, and you can have a solo date with your movies once a week, or whatever it is.
The compromise is really important.
Oh my gosh, if you're going to have
and the mourning part is very real. I had a couple just last week, and they're in their 50s, and she has no desire, and it's related to her menopause. And he actually was crying in the session.
Of course. He missed
so much. And just to be able to lie together naked and touch is a beginning, and to do sensate focus. I try to help couples get back on the sexual track.
It's really important, and I like being sexual even if I don't have an orgasm. I like being in the room with it. I like helping my partner get all the way there. I like performing oral sex. It works for me. And so if the female, if the person's lower desire doesn't feel pressured to have an orgasm every time, then they may be more willing to be more sexual more often.
That's a very good point. I like that. Talk a little more about that, because
Orgasm, orgasm is hard for me to get to. It takes a lot of energy, a lot of focus. It has to be exactly right. And then I'm done. I mean, I'm really done. And if I have to have a real orgasm, for me, that's work. That's an effort. To being around someone else having an orgasm, for me, that's fun. I love watching it, helping it, listening to it, facilitating it. I'll wear the funny clothes. I'll tickle your scrotum. I don't care. But if I have to go through it all myself, then it's like, really? So if the person who wants it more can really be okay with the fact their partner needs it less, and finding that compromise. If it's I can have sex, I can have sex on a set 3 or 4 days in a row and get very aroused and totally into it, not have a climax, and bank that energy for when I get to be with my husband alone. And then I know that orgasm is going to be really fantastic, extremely satisfying. I mean, I've never been an easy... my orgasmic threshold has always been very high, so I've never been able to. I'm not multiple. I don't orgasm easily, and women who do just astound and amaze me. It's like, wow, how do you do that? I don't know. How do you not do that? Really? So everyone's so different, and for people who and for couples where monogamy is really important, this is a very big deal that has to be renegotiated, and compromise must be reached in order to maintain intimacy and not increase resentment. Because I'm not physically horny doesn't mean I don't want to be close to my partner.
Nina, this is absolutely fascinating, and I just looked at the time, and we need to have a half-hour break here.
Oh, okay.
Just a couple of minutes break.
Yeah, but it's at the half-hour, and we're just a little bit past it. So a couple minutes. Stay tuned. I know you will want to hear more from Nina. She is fascinating.
My tuoi piedi, tap 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 tap. My tuoi piedi, tap 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 tap. Happy feet, da da da. Happy feet, da da da.
This is Dr. Diana Wiley, back with Love, Lust, and Laughter. My co-host is Brian Brewer, and our guest is Nina Hartley. Lots of you know about Nina Hartley. And just before the break, we were talking about orgasms, and I think that's a pretty good segue to your website, Nina.com, and you have a page there that I think is really good, Nina Hartley's Sex Tips. And tip number 14 is guide each other. No one gives you an orgasm. Our partners can only facilitate or hinder our finding our own orgasm. There are so many people that don't understand that. Why don't you explain that a little more?
Well, way back in the 70s, back in the early 70s, when the women's movement was really coming to the fore, younger listeners might not know that as far back as 1972, it was still very hard for an unmarried woman to get birth control. A married woman still needed her husband's permission to go on to birth control. Abortion was still illegal. Well, that changed in 72. Or 73.
I think it was 73, but anyway.
They were close enough. So the idea of women as property of their husbands was really still in the books. You couldn't wear pants to work, you know, harassment at work was not considered serious. It's things that we just would not stand for today were, you know, big problems back then. And, you know, oh, why are you being so sensitive? And so one of the early feminist, you know, this is the era of consciousness raising groups where women would get together and talk about their actual experiences and get a mirror and look at your vulva. Most women had never looked at their vulvas before. And then the whole idea of take responsibility for your orgasm. Remember that saying?
I do.
Yes. And so what does that mean? It sounds good. Take responsibility for your orgasm. There is no Prince Charming. You know, there is no knight in shining armor. You know, learn about
I have to just interject. I ran for 11 years two women's sexuality groups. I co-led them. And the idea was, someday my prince will come.
Yes.
And so will I.
Right. Boom, boom. Right. Exactly. So, again, so the idea... It's put forth for both men and women that if you love me, you'd know what I want. You could read my mind, because all of the woman's propaganda at the time, we fell together on the bed and were overswept by a wave of passion, and it was lovely. We had simultaneous orgasms. I've had two of those in my life, and I've been having sex since 1977. So, unless you have a very low
trip. And a lot of it, Nina.
A lot of it. Now, unless a woman has a very low orgasmic threshold, it's almost impossible to reliably have simultaneous orgasm without working at it, which I think is makes sex too goal-oriented. So the idea that take responsibility for your orgasm means I have to learn my own body and what it likes. All hail Betty Dodson's book, Sex for One, which teaches women how to do that.
It's a very good book.
It's a skill set you can learn if you're so motivated to do that. And so once I know what it is my body likes, then I can get this, share that with my partner, and they can help me. Now, for the longest time, some men would get very hurt or ego wounded over her saying left, right, up, down, softer, faster. But if you are with the right person for the right reasons, you will hopefully say what you need in a nice, sexy way so they don't turn off, and you will hear what they have to say with an open mind. So for me, as a woman-loving woman, I learned early on to get my ego out of the way because I get to be in the room while she's having pleasure. It behooves me to listen to what she says she wants. So get this, she'll ask me back. Aha! You know, so if I am actually listening to her body, listening to what she says, and helping her show herself a good time, I may get to do it again. And all I wanted to do is be in the room with the happy lady. So, so it's very, very juvenile emotionally. You didn't give me an orgasm. He didn't give me an orgasm. It's like, what, are you four? You know, it's not a pony. It's not a Barbie doll. It's your body. Do you know what you like? If you don't know what you like, how is he supposed to know what to do? Really, lady, honestly, grow up. And I'm obviously in session. I am not this way, but on radio, I can be a little more. Take responsibility for your orgasm. Get Betty's book. Get a Hitachi magic wand. Close the doors. Lock the windows. Figure out, what do I like? Do I like poetry? Do I like pictures, videos, movies, stories? What kind of things turn me on? What kind of themes turn me on? Does a particular thing come up over and over again? Maybe I can incorporate that somehow into my lovemaking to make myself more excited. You have to take responsibility for what it is you like. Your partner must do the same. So I tell people that, you know, young men, when I talk to college-age men, it really behooves you to learn to masturbate so you can stay in the happy zone for at least 20 minutes, and not by thinking of dead puppies, but actually this feels really good, and learn to withstand pleasure. Learning to tolerate sexual pleasure is a huge thing because most of us won't let ourselves do that. So, gentlemen, you should wait to have sex with another person until you can last at least 30 minutes. And, ladies, you should refrain from having partner sex until you can reliably give yourself an orgasm with or without assistance from somebody else. Then you're both at an even starting point. But if I'm in bed waiting for you to put me in the mood so that I can relax enough to have a good time, which was myself at 18, I just put all the responsibility onto my boyfriend for getting me in the mood, making me feel safe and relaxed, and I wasn't taking any responsibility. And guess what? The sex sucked.
Boy, Nina, hit on a great phrase about the ability to tolerate pleasure.
Yes.
And
say
most
more,
people
Brian.
Just think, well, pleasure, that's just fun. I would always enjoy that. But for a lot of people, intense sexual pleasure, it can create a lot of anxiety.
Oh, goodness, yes. And I've worked for years to rejigger my relationship to pleasure. My first was having orgasms. They really weren't very pleasurable. They were a physical reflex that I could make my body do. But it wasn't until I got Betty's book and really started working with what she said that I was able to tolerate. It went from tolerating a half second of pleasure before shutting down to now when we are really in the zone, I can tolerate, you know, intense sexual pleasure for minutes and minutes and minutes at a time without shutting down my breathing, my mind, my body, my emotions. That took years because your body can never lie to you. If you can do the homework and recalibrate your relationship to erotic pleasure, not just massage pleasure or eating pleasure, but erotic pleasure, all of your training and all of your history will be shown to you, because those are the roadblocks your mind will set up in front of you. Why you should stop, why you can't. Fear will come up, anger will come up, loneliness, all the so-called negative emotions will come up trying to stop you from exploring this in this area. But if we can do it, since our bodies hold everything that ever has happened to us, and pleasure is the only way through it. It's like a machete. You just have to just keep a minute today, a minute and a half tomorrow, 2 minutes on Thursday, little bit at a time, and eventually all will be revealed to you. And then if you can do that work along with a good sex therapist, you can really move along quite quickly. But even if, God forbid, you can't afford therapeutic support, your body will always be there for you, because your body is stuck right now. It cannot go in the past. It cannot go in the future. It could only be right here. And pleasure is a lovely way to induce yourself to stay in the present moment. And
pleasure,
as you do
and
that,
play, because play is so reciprocal.
Yes, absolutely,
so,
very difficult.
People need to play more in sex.
Well, for sure. I mean, done properly, sex is adult play, but we don't permit ourselves to do that because we're going to feel stupid or silly or wear the funny costume. It's like, you get to wear a costume. You're alone with your partner. Wear the costume.
Exactly. You know, we dress for success. We should dress for sex.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it doesn't take much. You know, you don't need the whole maid outfit, but a little apron does one, whatever, you know. But it took me years to feel comfortable doing role play because it felt so stupid. It wasn't until I got with a partner who I liked a lot and was experienced at role play that it stopped feeling stupid and started feeling more natural. But, you know, role play, for especially for most people, it's like, this is so dumb. Can I take the hat off now, please? You know?
But this is, Nina, this is where, you know, going back to the top of the show, where you were quoted as saying, the message that you have about sex is to be competent and confident. And a lot of people can't get there till they're a little closer to 50. It's about life experience. It's about developing confidence. There's that crossover effect where sometime after 50, many men become more romantic and many women become more assertive. They're able to talk about what they need and want, and the man slows down, and it takes time, and the woman needs that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice kind of gender reversal, but to be more differentiated. David Snarch, you probably know about him.
David who?
Snarch.
S-N-A-R-C-H? I do not know him.
Well, he talks about differentiation and that you'll probably have the best sex of your life in your late 40s, 50s, 60s.
I'm certainly having the best sex of my life in my personal life, for sure.
Yeah.
Because I have a mature relationship with a loving partner who, I people say, what's the secret to your happy marriage? Like, partner selection? You know, I held out for someone whose sexual values overlap with mine in the most crucial ways. And for us, that includes being an open couple, a sexually non-exclusive couple. But for me, that was a requirement. I wasn't going to mate again with a partner who was jealous or possessive, because that ruined my first marriage completely. And even back in the 70s, where we say, you know, speak truth to power, your happiness is important, I still was not able in my first marriage to own up to the fact that my partner's jealousy and possessiveness was killing everything. And I waited years to be able to speak about it and was resentful for years. I've had a really bad marriage, and I've done all the things that happen in bad marriages, lying, withholding, resentment, petty BS, and all the kinds of things. So having, I knew that when I became single that I would remain single and have cats and lovers before I would partner again with a possessive with a person who was jealous. I don't care anything else about them, how good looking they were, successful, fabulous, funny, witty, whatever. If they thought they owned that part of me, no go. And I don't feel I own that part of my partner. Because I consider my partners fully sexually autonomous beings. We happen to really like boning each other, which is awesome. But there's a certain part of him that I can't dance with, and a certain part of me that he can't dance with. And they're important parts. And so we agree and understand that sometimes we need outside partners. And we have lots of threesomes with friends, and so that helps a lot. But to hold that place together stays together, and play has different meanings for different couples.
Well,
if we could just shift gears for a moment, I know that sometimes you're called upon to participate in debates about the morality of pornography.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, both Diane and I are very sex positive and open. But I wonder if, for our listeners, are there any arguments you hear from the other side that have some validity?
I don't put much. I don't think they do, because they're often coming from places of, for me, an antiquated Judeo-Christian notion of what sex is properly for. And for people who don't share those values, trying to live them is problematic. If a person is monogamous and wants to, you know, have their sexuality express their faith, wonderful. I'm absolutely for it, and no one should be made to view pornography, doesn't want to see it or be exposed to it, doesn't want to be exposed to it, or made to act anything out in it that they don't want to act out. So I'm absolutely in favor of 100%, you know, sexual freedom for adults to do or not do, read or not read, watch or not watch any particular thing. Most of the problems against pornography, I think, are first projected issues of the person doing the speaking. So if you're a feminist, if you don't like pornography from a certain feminist perspective, it's because it's demeaning to women and it objectifies women, et cetera, et cetera. And if you are a religious-based person, it is immoral because it is adultery, it is putting ideas in people's heads, it is not making sex sacred. But it is a entertainment medium, and in our culture we get to say what we want about entertainment, movies, TV, reality shows, game shows. We get to have opinions about media and about entertainment, but the arguments against it are deeply personal. As long as the material is created by consenting adults under legal conditions, meaning people are of age, they know what they're being paid to do, they've consented to what they're being paid to do, they signed the model release, they know why they're there. Obviously, so there's illegal pornography, which is completely indefensible, and there's legal pornography, which is completely defensible, even if it's tasteless, tacky, vulgar, puerile, juvenile, stupid, ugly, hateful, whatever. There's lots of media out there that I hate. I don't like the Saw movies. I don't like the Hostel movies. I don't like torture porn movies. I don't like, you know, I don't like thrillers. I don't like slasher movies. Those movies I really hate. I'm sorry they're there. I don't understand the appeal, but I'm a First Amendment person, and so, okay, if they can find an audience and make money, I guess there's enough people out there who don't share my opinion that movie can make money. It always comes down to people seeing something out there in the world they don't like, and they want it to go away. It's a very young, emotionally young response. I don't like that. You take it away. You go away.
Right.
As opposed to, wow, I don't like this in the world. What can I do? What can I do to avoid being exposed to it? What can I do to maybe work against it on legal grounds or things of that nature? But sexuality is so... it's so rarely in the box that our culture has assigned it to, that any exposure to non-traditional sexual expression upsets a lot of people, because it tickles the parts of them that maybe didn't quite swallow the training whole, and so they don't like being reminded of bits and pieces that they still have issues with. So if we're talking about legal pornography, meaning, again, people of age and consenting adults, literally consenting adults, then there is no argument to be made against it except one of poor taste. And let's face it, and pornography, the culture gets the pornography it deserves. All culture is extremely conflicted about sex and sexuality. We keep people ignorant about it. We tell them lies about it, but we use it, we sublimate their sexuality and twist it and deform it, and then sell it back to them by using a girl in bikini to sell a car. Well, I can't use a topless girl to sell sex, but I can use a girl in bikini to sell a power drill. So they always say sex sells, but sex sells when the population is still largely ignorant of its own motivations and own desires. And so we play on sexual fear, we play on sexual fantasy, we play on sexual desire, but we don't actually acknowledge and say that's a good thing. So, you know, sex is used to sell everything. I mean, the shirtless Pepsi diet soda person, you know, he was using sex appeal to sell diet soda, but we can't use sex appeal to sell sex. You know, what's wrong with this picture?
Good point.
You make so many good points. I mean, you're so articulate, and it's no wonder that you're in demand to talk about this sort of thing. And it's really been, we still have some time, but I just want to say before we have to stop a few minutes before the hour, but a couple minutes. You know, it's quite refreshing to have somebody like you, because you're so articulate and you're so experienced. And you have opinions, and you share them.
Oh yes, I've never been shy about sharing them. It's really important to get people talking about it. And in the 40 years since the sexual revolution really took off in the early 70s, there's so much good material out there. Again, people, Carol Queen, Patrick Califia, Gail Rubin, Susie Bright, Greta Christina, Betty Dodson, Jamie Waxman, myself included, have all written these really wonderful, wonderful books about sex and sexuality that are from a healthy point of view. So there's certainly lots of support out there. There are more sex-positive sex therapists now who are not invested in trying to keep people monogamous, because that's what healthy sexuality is. For every Dr. Phil who says, you know, threesomes are always bad for a relationship, it's like, well, it depends on the people. You know, for me, threesomes are really healthy for my relationship. They add a lot of wonderful things to my husband's and my relationship with my husband, and, you know, and yet for other couples, that would be the death knell. And so to have these blanket statements, you know, threesomes are never good, that's just, for me, ignorant and shaming. It depends. It depends. So people can do lots of self-education out there. There's a lot of information around now where, you know, people are telling their truth about sexuality. And here's what I tell people. When they're reading media about sex that's not pornographic, there are two big, broad categories. There's one set of media that, if you read it, you can tell they're trying to make you scared or angry or feel stupid, lost, or alone. They're working on your fear receptors. They're really trying to make you feel inadequate and not up to the task of running your own sex life. And then there's the people who write in such a way as to clearly trying to help you learn to figure it out for yourself. So there is a group out there who wants to keep you unhappy, sad, off base, ignorant, alone feeling, and there's a group of people out there writing about sex who want you to become empowered, self-aware, knowledgeable, and lower your shame. So obviously I encourage people to read the second type of blogging and books out there around sexuality, and just recognize a little bit media criticism, and recognize, what is this person trying to get me to do? Feel angry, like a victim, alone, hysterical, disgusted, fearful, you know, etc., or hopeful and someone sensing that I can do for myself. And if you just let that be your guide, you'll find the right writings for you.
Nina, you are wonderful.
Well, thank you. I'll come. Now, by the way, I'll send you an email, and if there's something I can tweet about, and, like, this will go on an archive, is this an internet radio thing?
Yes, I'm going to, as soon as this is over, I'm going to go write a summary, and PRN, Progressive Radio Network, that we're on, will put it up. And, by the way, they would like you to send an image to go with that you would like to have up there. Can you do that?
I could do that.
Okay, so I'll send you a copy of, now the listeners are getting in all this inside stuff, but I'll send you a copy of the summary once I've done it.
Okay.
But You know, you're doing such important work, and Brian, I know you want to chime in here.
Well, yeah, I just want to just say again to remind people to go to nina.com, N-I-N-A.com.
It is not safe for work. Please be careful where you access that site.
Yes, that's a good point. It does have explicit material on there.
But if you go to YouTube and look up Tuesdays with Nina, some non-explicit sex ed clips did it. Questions have migrated from the original site they were on onto YouTube, and that's something you can show anybody. I'm fully dressed. I'm just talking. And Tuesdays with Nina on YouTube, there are like 100 episodes.
Wow.
And those you can show anybody over 18 because they're not, again, there's no nudity. There's no...
Okay, Nina, we gotta.
Okay.
And
okay.
This, I'm so sorry. Let's do a part two
pleasure.
One of these days. Okay.
Okey-dokey.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Nina. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And thank you, Brian. And thank you for all of you listening, and a lot of you will tune in for the archives. And I know you'll agree this has been an informed and entertaining show. See you next week.
My boy getting up, 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 up. My boy getting up, 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 up. Happy feet. Da, 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 happy feet. Da, 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 happy feet. Oh, I love it.
Love it.
Happy feet. Da, 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 happy feet. Da, 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 happy feet.